Hello and welcome once again to this series of podcasts brought to you by Kilkenny Library Services in partnership with the Decade of Centenaries Fund. My name is Owen Swinton Welsh, and in these podcasts we focus on revolutionary era Kilkenny. In part one of this episode we looked at the life and times of our two main protagonists, that is Pat Welsh and Sean Quinn. Today I will examine in detail what happened in the last days of their lives and how they came to find themselves in the fields of Tullerone, where they made their last stand. Friday the 13th, 1921, lived up to its bad reputation for 34-year-old Pat Welsh of Dunamagan and 22-year-old Sean Quinn of Mulnahone. So what I will try to do first is set the scene of what was happening at the time and how the flying column Pat and Sean were part of ended up where they were. So now, just to pick up from where we left off on the first episode, as mentioned, Pat Welsh, the captain of the Dunamagan IRA, had just been released from Waterford Jail on the 18th of April 1921, where he had served his sentence for having seditious documents. He quickly resumed his IRA activities. Just a week after his release, himself and some local IRA men were surprised on the road one night by a lorry of Crown Forces in the townland of Haggard, that's near Dunamagan. The men who were spotted decided to make a run for it through the fields. They knew they probably would get a beating at a minimum if they were captured and perhaps even arrested. Shots were fired by the Crown Forces, who gave chase, and local IRA man Pat Holden was injured, but none of the men were caught. From a Crown Forces perspective, a group of young men together at night were up to no good, which was probably the case here. However, a coat belonging to Pat Welsh had been dropped in the chase and his name was sewn onto it. There was now a reason to have him arrested again. Thus, Pat knew he could not stay at home any longer for the fear of being arrested. He was no use to anyone in jail. Pat stayed locally in a network of safe houses, mostly in Danganmore, which is near the Dunamagan village. Just 2 weeks later, around the 8th of May, two flying columns moved into Danganmore and were put up by the locals. The local IRA company officer, John Hickey, organised their digs, which was no easy feat, as you can imagine. One of the columns was the West Kilkenny Flying Column, headed by Ned Elward, who we talked about already. This consisted of about 14 men, including Sean Quinn. Now, the other flying columns present there was unusual in that it was from neighbouring Tipperary. It was made up of over 40 men, so that's nearly three times the size of the Kilkenny column. Sean Hogan, that's he of the Knocklong Escape and Solohead Beg fame, was the leader of this Tipperary No. 2 flying column, as it was called. It generally functioned in the southern part of Tipperary. Hogan's column even had a machine gun in its possession, which had been captured from the Crown Forces. This move by the Tipperary men into Kilkenny had been sanctioned by IRA GHQ, it would appear. A few months previously, when the new Kilkenny Brigade OC, that's George O'Dwyer, had his first face-to-face meeting with Michael Collins in Dublin in December 1920, Collins had insisted that some big attacks should take place in Kilkenny to take the pressure off Tipperary and Cork. He encouraged the linking up of the battalions and columns between the counties. His aim was to compel the Crown Forces to transfer troops from those areas into County Kilkenny, thus spreading the pressure more evenly. Since March 1921, all of Kilkenny, most of Tipperary and parts of Limerick were encompassed into a single IRA division by IRA GHQ. It was called the 2nd Southern Division. In overall charge of this entire division was none other than Ernie O'Malley. Obviously, O'Malley would not have had fond memories of Kilkenny, as he was captured in Inistigue just a few months previously. Looking at it from his point of view, in purely militaristic terms, he saw no county boundaries on his divisional map. What he saw was a much heavier concentration of army and black and tans in the Tipperary geographical area, mostly due to the disturbed nature of that county since 1919, in comparison to Kilkenny, which had much less. In addition, he would have been aware that softer targets for the IRA in Tipperary were becoming scarcer and scarcer. Although the Crown Forces had more personnel in that region, they seemed to only travel in large convoys for their own safety, which were a much more difficult and dangerous target for the IRA. In Kilkenny, there were more softer targets still available to the IRA. Having less of a concentration of black and tans, military and RIC in Kilkenny would also give Hogan's column some breathing room. Hence, it made sense that O'Malley encouraged outside columns to enter Kilkenny in May 1921. Ned Elward, the commander of the West Kilkenny Flying Column, had received a dispatch while billeting in Winegap, informing him of Hogan's presence in Kilkenny. As luck would have it, Elward and his column were at a bit of a loose end. They had been in South Kilkenny for some time in the Kilmacow, Munkine and Piltown areas with the aim of attacking the RIC based out of Fidown Barracks in Piltown. They were lucky to escape a firefight actually in Bessborough Domain in Piltown. When they rendezvoused in Dunamagan, Ned Elward and Sean Hogan decided that they would form one super column, which would have upwards of 50 plus men, and move around together. The enlarged column would then trek en masse to North Kilkenny and stir up trouble as they travelled, with the ultimate aim of attacking Urlingford RIC barracks near the Kilkenny-Tipperary border. There was a rough plan also of linking up with George O'Dwyer's East Kilkenny Flying Column, and dispatches were sent to him with that in mind. That would have been three columns having an all-out assault on the barracks in Urlingford if it had all come to pass. And just a little note on flying columns. In Ireland in general, by May 1921, flying columns had become more of a necessity than of a choice. Important IRA men in the district were often known to Crown forces and were therefore in constant danger of being arrested if they stayed in their own homes. Many of these men were now required to go on the run, so the next logical step for them was to join a flying column so they could be of some use. It was at this time that Pat Welsh, the captain of the Dunamagan IRA, decided to join the column as he felt it would be a much better use of his time instead of hiding in safe houses around Dunamagan waiting to be caught. It's also likely he felt now was the time to put into practice all that he had learnt in the military magazines over the previous years. It was at this time, around the 8th of May, that Pat Welsh met Sean Quinn. Little did they know that they would fall side by side just a few days later. It is not known if they had been acquainted before this. It is possible their paths had crossed, but Pat was an officer in the IRA and Sean was a regular soldier, so he wouldn't have met him at the 7th Battalion meetings, etc. There was also a 12-year age gap. Their paths were more likely to have crossed on the GAA fields, although both men were in different GAA jurisdictions. But either way, their fates were now intertwined. Just as an aside, another member of the Tipperary column was Tom Ryan, who had played midfield for Tipperary on Bloody Sunday in November 1920, just 6 months previously. Also in the Tipperary column was Sean Hayes, who was elected a TD for Tipperary in later life. On the 9th of May, having been fed and watered by the locals and the women of Cumann na Mban in Danganmore, which was no easy task considering the amount of men that arrived, the joint flying columns moved northwards with the aim of reaching the village of Kilmana. This was a journey of over 20 kilometres. They stayed the next 2 nights, firstly at Newtown and Kells and later at Shipton House near Kilmana, which was a famed safe house in the area ran by Molly and Kitty Tien. While most of the column travelled on foot, Hogan and Elward, along with a few lucky column men, travelled in an Overlord motor car. This car had been taken from the Crown Forces by Hogan's column in Clonmel. It certainly was a bold, if cheeky, move. In propaganda terms, it showed that the IRA flying columns were able to drive in broad daylight around the countryside without being captured in a stolen car that had been taken from the military. It certainly was rubbing their noses in us, to say the least. It said to the average inhabitants of South Tipperary and Kilkenny that these guys meant business and weren't afraid to be out in the open. In practical terms, the car was used to hold spare supplies of clothes along with the machine gun and hand grenades. But in purely militaristic terms, although courageous and brazen, it alerted people far and wide, friends and enemies alike, to their presence in the area. The sound of motorised engines at this time was a rare noise. People would have taken note of us, as it usually meant the military were in the area. Very few people had cars and the military permit was required to drive one. They were now boldly coming out into the open and goading the Crown Forces. This was something that had not been seen in County Kilkenny up to that point. When thinking about the use of this motor car, Ned Elward in later life did say that he thought it was, quote, rather suicidal to be driving along the roads in this car, not knowing the minutes we would run bang into a military or black and tan party, end quote. Nevertheless, it's interesting to contemplate how Elward and Sean Hogan got on. You would think they would have got on reasonably well, although Elward himself said he had known Dinny Lacy, the leader of the other flying column in South Tipperary, much better. Elward was a no-frills man of action. He preferred to act on something rather than talk about it endlessly. The daringness of Sean Hogan must have spurred him on. They had that much in common anyway. Also, it's easy to forget how young these men were. Ned Elward was only 25. Sean Hogan was even younger. He only turned 21 years of age on the 12th of May 1921, the day he took over Kilmarnock Village, which I will describe next. What a way to celebrate your 21st. And he commanded men that were often much older than him, so it showed he was able to garner that kind of respect. So back to our story. At 6 a.m. on the morning of the 12th of May, that's Sean Hogan's 21st birthday, as we said, the giant super column had reached the village of Kilmarnock. They had a plan to take over the entire village with the aim of drawing out the Crown forces so they could attack them. There had been hopes the Crown forces would be in the vicinity anyway due to an auction of a farm being held locally. Column men were positioned at entry points into the village. None of the villagers were allowed to leave Kilmarnock that day and no civilians were allowed in. A number of horse and carts were placed together in a field on high ground to act as a makeshift lookout post, which offered 360-degree views of the countryside. A number of the local houses in the village were commandeered by the column men, and they even erected posters stating that the village was in a Republican military area. When there was no sign of the Crown forces coming, they purposely sent word asking for help, in inverted commas, to the Kilkenny, Sissy and Callan barracks through the post office network in an attempt to draw the Crown forces to the area. They had arrested the postmistress, Mrs. Kelly, and confiscated her equipment to avoid unwanted communications getting out. The tension was palpable all day in the village. The locals were on tenterhooks, fearing things were about to kick off at any minute. It is not known specifically where Pat Welch and Sean Quinn spent that day in Kilmarnock, although Tommy Ryan of the Tipperary column said he became friendly with Quinn, as he said Quinn was very interested in Gaelic football and they talked away about that, Ryan being an intra-county Tipperary footballer, of course. If this battle had come to fruition, it would have been the largest fight in the southeast of Ireland during the War of Independence up to that point, especially considering the amount of column men present. Their base did not work, however. By evening, the column leaders felt obliged to withdraw northwards to safety as the element of surprise had dissipated. In addition, the Crown forces could have snuck up on them by force, with the darkness acting as their cover. The IRA column marched from Kilmarnock at about 6:30 p.m, having been in the village for over 12 hours at that stage. The events of Kilmarnock turned out to be a great publicity coup for the IRA nonetheless, with the Irish Independent newspaper headlining it "The Invasion of Kilmarnock," where it said 300 Sinn Féiners invaded the village, which was at least four times the actual number, of course. Here is some of that newspaper article. Quote, "A flying column of about 300 Sinn Féiners fortified several houses and seized the post office telephone instruments. Outposts were posted around the village and armed men patrolled the streets. Printed notices were posted up declaring the village to be a military area and stating that any member of the Crown Forces found carrying arms without a permit from the IRA would be shot at sight. For several hours the town was occupied with considerable displays of military ceremonial." End quote. However, unbeknownst to the column men, large sections of the British forces pursued in their wake after they had left. The column retired northwards to a number of safe houses around the parishes of Tullerone and Ballycallan. The two leaders, Hogan and Elward, along with 15 of the men, rested at the home of Tom Kennedy, who lived with his mother Kate and sister Sadie in the townland of Knocknamook, about 5 kilometres northwest of Tullerone village. The famished men were all fed and watered, with Sadie Kennedy fortuitously having just killed a pig. The remainder of the column were told to muster at that location early the following day. Late in the night, three of the column, that's Pat Welch, Sean Quinn and Paddy Power from Kilmagany, who were staying at Nicholas Hines in Ballycallan, decided they would prefer to go to Kennedy's now to get some rest, instead of having to get up early to find a house the next morning. They arrived at Kennedy's just as day broke and rested in an outhouse so as not to disturb the sleeping column men in the main house. On the morning of Friday the 13th of May, which would prove to be very unlucky, the stillness of the rural Kilkenny countryside was broken at 11 a.m. with the sound of lorries. This could only mean one thing. The scouts, that's local IRA men Robert Campion and Michael Brennan, ran into Kennedy's house and reported that Crown forces had stopped at the top of the lane leading to Kennedy's farm. Elward and Hogan had only sat down to their pork breakfast at the time. They'd even consciously made an allowance in eating meat on a Friday, which of course was a fast day. The column men fled from the house as quietly as they could in the direction of the back fields. They went by the dikes and ditches, which gave them some cover. Kate Kennedy was throwing holy water on the men as they left the house. The men were in various states of dress, but made sure to bring their weapons and ammo with them. Elward and Hogan had to say goodbye to their motor car, which was parked in Kennedy's yard. Unaware of what was unfolding, and unknown to the rest of the column that were fleeing Kennedy's, Sean Quinn, Pat Welsh and Paddy Power were still in the outhouse. Paddy Power, who was shaving at the time, heard the commotion and he ventured out tentatively. He figured out what was happening and told Pat Welsh and woke up Sean Quinn. It's possible the men froze for a second or two, wondering to wait it out or to hide and try to bluff their way out of it, or perhaps just to hide. But eventually they decided to run after the rest of the column, who had ran towards the back fields. Valuable time had been lost, however, as we will see. By the way, the Crown forces obviously had very accurate information. They went directly to Kennedy's house, so they must have known that the leadership of the column in the Overlord motor car were believed to be there. The cordon that the Crown forces initiated, which had to have been pre-planned, was totally focused on the Kennedy farmstead, even though there were IRA column men billeting in houses across the road from Kennedy's lane. Now, if you can try to visualise the scene, it may help understand the predicament faced by the flying column. Bear with me now. In simple terms, there was two roads running horizontally, kind of parallel. A high road, known as Healy's or sometimes the Tubbard Road, and a low road, known as the New England Road. In between these two roads was a patchwork of fields, ditches and dikes, much like any area of rural County Kilkenny. The entrance to Kennedy's farm was from the lane on the high road. Therefore, the column men logically moved south to get to the low or the New England road via the ditches and dikes and hopefully to safety. However, the Crown forces were well planned that morning. A number of lorries had come from Kilkenny. Lorries of Crown forces were placed on the high road and on the low road. In other words, they simply did not all just arrive into Kennedy's farmyard. Then in textbook military fashion, the Crown forces on both roads fanned out and moved slowly through the fields from both directions. This was to create a cordon around Kennedy's house and to ensnare any would-be escapees. Every minute counted for the column men in order to break out of that cordon before the net closed. They were lucky to have cover as they moved along the sunken dikes and ditches to get as far away from Kennedy's house as possible. They had yet to be spotted by the Crown forces. They had gone a good distance away from the farmhouse when they reached somewhat of a dead end in a sunken dike. They were faced with a high bank which prevented them going any further. This was between what was known as Cody's Field, where they were, and Campion's Field, which was the next field over from the bank. The only way to go on was to climb over the high bank to get to the dikes and the ditches on the other side, which would give them cover again. But by going over the high bank, they would be out in the open, and there for all the Crown forces in the surrounding fields to see. So they decided to lay low here for a while, as they could see with the help of field goggles, that's a kind of like binoculars, that the Crown forces that had come into Kennedy's were not coming in their direction. In fact, luckily for the IRA column, they seemed to be already outside the military cordon coming down from Kennedy's and the high Rathealy Road. Pat, Sean and Paddy were also staying still where they were further back, unsure of where exactly their comrades were. They likely thought they were miles away by now. As the day progressed, Elward and Hogan decided getting over the high bank was a risk worth taking. At this stage, they were closer to the low or the New England Road than to the high road. The tip men, that's Hogan, Sean Hayes and the Nagel brothers, were going to climb up first with the aim of getting a better look and providing covering fire if needed for protecting the rest of the column. Most eyes were focused looking north, back to Kennedy's where they had come from. What they couldn't see until they climbed up onto the bank was that there were soldiers coming from the south, that's the New England side. The Crown forces coming from this side had come up through the farmyard owned by Ned Tehan and his family, just up a lane from the New England Road near the townland of Knocknagress, which of course is close to where their memorial is at the present day. So as the column men climbed up onto the bank, they just weren't to know that the soldiers were actually in the field south of them already. Quite quickly, though, through the corner of his eye, one of the Nagel brothers saw the oncoming threat and shouted, "Tin hats, lads," meaning the soldiers. After a few shouts from the crowd and forces, the bullets started to fly. The soldiers dropped down for cover. Hogan and Hayes and some of the rest of the column blazed bullets in their direction, while the soldiers responded in kind. One by one, the column men, along with the two scouts who had joined them in their run from the farm, scrambled over the high bank and down the other side. No doubt happy their fellow IRA men were providing cover fire. Sean Hayes and some of the other column men then fired northwards, as shots were now starting to come from the Kennedy direction too. The Crown forces coming from that side were obviously alerted to the firing and all converged on that one spot. Bullets were sparking off the stone wall and tin roof of the Tehan family farm in the distance, and the Tehan children, who had been out playing in the yard, there was three boys and a girl in the family, all under 9, were quickly brought inside, as you can imagine. Neither side was severely wounded, although one of the Crown Forces, Scott Wilson, was hit with a bullet wound into the hand. Tom Mullaney of the tip column also received a bad wound, the bullet having passed straight through his arm. Tom Ryan carried him on his back. Once all the column men were over the high bank, Hogan and Elward jumped down and moved southwards through the dikes. The Crown Forces needed time to regroup, and the column men used that to their advantage. They moved quickly south through the dikes and ran quickly across the New England Road and moved southwards away from danger. They had escaped. Elward remembered in later life that an old lady, who was actually Stacia Hine, told him the positions of the lorries converging on the area, which aided their escape greatly. They had just crossed the road before Crown Force reinforcements arrived. The 30 or more column men who were staying in the other safe houses around the area also managed to escape unscathed. They all later regrouped in Ballingarry, which is about 20 kilometres away. The Urlingford Barracks attack plan was now very much out the window. However, little did Hogan and Elward know, three column men, Sean Quinn, Pat Welsh and Paddy Power, were still just a little behind them in the dikes, maybe just 50 to 100 yards behind at this stage. These three men would have been close to the gun battle that was taking place between their column comrades and the Crown Forces. It perhaps sealed the fate of the three stragglers, as the majority of the Crown Force personnel were now converging on that area where the gunfire was taking place, close to where they now were. Pat, Sean and Paddy had moved as quickly as they could towards the high bank to catch up with their comrades, but they just arrived too late. Some of the soldiers had spotted them on their way through the dikes. They could not possibly get over the high bank now without being shot, as all eyes were now on that area. They would have been sitting ducks. They decided they would climb the bank where they were to get onto Tehan's field and just try and make a free run for it down towards the New England Road and hopefully catch up with the rest of the column, which they now knew were heading in that direction. They would not have been aware where the soldiers were in Tehan's field because they simply had no view down the dike. They decided to ascend all three at the same time and make a run for it. Up they went from the bank of the dike, but just as they emerged onto Tehan's field, there was immediately a volley of shots. The Crown Forces must have been at a relatively close range, as both Welsh and Quinn were immediately hit. Luckily for Paddy Power, he'd been knocked off balance by Quinn and had not emerged from the dike at the same time as the rest of them. Quinn lost his footing and grabbed Power to regain his balance. This knocked Power back into the dike. That unintentional incident, which probably happened in a split second or two, likely saved Paddy Power's life. Power then backtracked along the dike and moved north along a different dike. He miraculously escaped being caught by submerging himself in the dike water and covering himself in rushes and remaining still for the rest of the day until nightfall. He then went into Tehan's farm, who were shocked to see him, to say the least. Once Power had warmed up, three local IRA men, Tom Hennessy, Mick O'Neill and Jack Dermody, brought him to Houlihan's of Galdstown, another safe house in the area. The day must have been very traumatic for Power. I don't mean just a traumatic run through the dikes, but he could also hear his two comrades thrashing and moaning in an agony on the field for some time as the military left him there while they combed the area. A horse and cart was eventually commandeered from Willie Cody, who had been working in Tehan's farm nearby. The two severely injured wounded men were brought up through the fields on the cart and placed in a military lorry. Pat was armed only with a shotgun when he was shot, which wouldn't have been a match for the army type guns, but he also had a revolver. A rifle was the main thing a flying column man wanted at that time, but Pat had only joined up 5 days beforehand and had no way of getting a decent weapon that quickly. Sean Quinn had a revolver and the rifle he had taken from Black and Tan Ernest Riley 2 months previously in Gary Ricken. The two injured men were left for 2 hours on the lorry on the way back to Kilkenny when the Crown Forces visited a public house known as Keeley's or Butler's, more recently known as the Valley Inn, near Talbot Crossroads. The captured and badly injured men were denied food and water, which locals attempted to provide them with. The Crown Forces took over the pub and drank for some hours, no doubt happy with their day's work. They had shot two rebels, captured the overlord motor car, all the while having none of their own ranks badly wounded. The drinking of a local pub dry was considered something of an unofficial reprisal policy to show the locals this is what happens to you when you harbour rebels. Sean Quinn dipped in and out of consciousness that day. Pat, however, was able to converse with him, although he himself was in much pain. Another local man arrested that day was Michael Purcell, who was from a well-known blacksmith's family at nearby Kildrina. He was acting as an IRA scout that day and was spotted on a hill earlier, signalling the approach of Crown Forces, using a large white handkerchief to communicate. He was spotted by field goggles by the military, and Purcell was arrested when they snuck up on him. He was thrown into the lorry with the two fatally wounded IRA men, much to his shock, as you can imagine. He was later found guilty and charged, although the scouts on the other hills around did escape, including Michael's brother Jack. Not long after arriving at Kilkenny Military Barracks, now known as James Stevens Barracks, 22-year-old Sean Quinn passed away, having been shot in the abdomen. He was given the last rites by the military chaplain, that's Father Charles Kavanagh, from nearby St. John's Church. He was subsequently buried in his adopted village of Mulnahone at a large funeral. Some weeks later, his mother received a letter from Father Kavanagh, which vividly describes his last moments. Quote, "I write to you about the last minutes of your poor son John. He was brought to the military barracks around 7 p.m. I was with him myself and Patrick Welch. Both were in the same room from 8 p.m. to 9:30 p.m. John was perfectly conscious and I was well able to make his confession. He received the Holy Communion, the sacrament of extreme unction, the last blessing, and was able to answer the litany for the dying. He recited all the prayers most devotedly. He was perfectly resigned to die. He suffered great pain but bore it bravely and offered it all to God. I also attended poor Pat Welch, who died a few days later. Both, I must say, were most anxious to die." End quote. The way letters of this type are composed at the time were an attempt to comfort the mother, firstly saying that he received a full, complete set of prayers and sacraments for the sick and dying, and secondly to say they were anxious to die, meaning they were at peace with it. This is to try and relieve the worry somewhat, if that was any way possible for a bereaved parent. As the remains of Sean made their way from Callan to Mulnahone for his funeral mass, a poignant and touching sight happened when Sean's comrades in the flying column waited for him to pass at a Pacific crossroads at Hanur. They were viewing it from a distance. As his remains went past, they dipped arms in formation as a tribute to their fallen comrade. They couldn't, of course, attend the burial as they could easily have been arrested. He'd been one of the men that made the dramatic escape from Gary Rickenhouse just 2 months earlier, but his luck had now run out. Sean's mother, Lizzie, was not informed in time of her son's death and could not attend the burial. At the time, burials took place very quickly after this, and Sean's mother, of course, was in Westmead. She did receive a letter, however, from one of his comrades, Joseph Walsh, of Kickham Street in Mulnahone, in the weeks after his death. The letter included the following. "Dear Mrs. Quinn, on behalf of Jack's comrades, both footballers and fighters, I wish you to accept our sympathy. We who knew him since he was a boy of 16 years can never forget the loss to ourselves of a trusted comrade who gave all so that Ireland might live. We can quite appreciate the great loss of such a son. Indeed, while we should regret his loss more than we do, you ought to be as proud and still more proud than we are that God has chosen your son to be one amongst Ireland's heroes. We got official news of his death on Saturday evening, but owing to the wires being cut, no telegram could be sent until Tuesday morning. We were sorry you could not be at the funeral, for it was a sight that was to be remembered, and one that always will inspire happiness, even at such a time. The coffin had a glass panel, and all who wished could see Jack in his last long peaceful sleep, looking quite happy. The 1,000 that met the cortege in Callan paid a glowing tribute by kneeling on the road and reciting the rosary in Irish. There was a display by the military. They took the pall, that's the Irish tricolour flag, from off the coffin, but did not proceed further. There was no disorder of any kind. If at any time you wish to visit the grave, I would be very happy to meet you and give you further information." End quote. Powerful stuff there. It is not known if Lizzie Quinn ever visited her son's grave. It is doubtful, as she did not last long after her son. She appears to have suffered some form of a brain hemorrhage or stroke around the time Sean died. When she was dying in 1923, just 2 years after Sean, she appealed to the newly instated Free State government for financial help, evoking the memory of her son who had given his life for that same independent parliament. Her appeal made it onto the floor of the Dáil. Detailing her plight, she said that she had been confined to bed for the previous 2 years as a result of pains. She was totally reliant on the generosity of her neighbours who looked after her and fed her. She did receive £28 from the Irish White Cross charity to help her after her son's death, but it was all to no avail. Lizzie Dolan died in Mullingar some 2 weeks after the appeal to the Dáil on the 12th of October 1923 as a result of the effects of the stroke she had suffered 2 years previously. She was just 58 years of age and died just 2.5 years after the death of her son. She had never remarried after the death of Sean's father some 20 years previously. Now we will return to the face of Pat Welsh. After a night in Kilkenny barracks, the severely injured Pat was transferred by military ambulance to the main military hospital in Fermoy, County Cork. His wounds had quickly become infectious and then gangrenous. In an era before antibiotics, infections were always life-threatening. This was especially the case with such bad wounds. Pat was shot in both legs. On Wednesday, the 18th of May 1921, having just had an operation to amputate his left leg from the thigh bone, Pat Welsh died of shock, which likely meant blood loss following the operation. This was 5 days after the events of Knocknagress Tullerone. Indeed, it is possible that he could have survived his wounds if he had received earlier medical intervention to remove the bullets and stop the infection. He had just turned 34 years old 2 weeks previously on the 4th of May. He died in Fermoy on the day his fallen comrade Sean Quinn was buried in Mullinahone. Following his death, two members of the Namagan IRA, John Hickey and Pat Holden, rented a hackney car from Bill Egan of Callan to drive to Fermoy. They had to get permits from the military in Callan beforehand. It was on a long, arduous journey through damaged roads, but they got there just in time, as the military had already dug a grave to inter Pat if his body had not been claimed that day. As the Kilkenny Journal newspaper wrote in reaction to his death, quote, "The death of Pat caused genuine regret among all who knew him, those who differed from him, as well as among his intimate associates." End quote. The funeral of Patrick Welsh was held in the Namagan on Sunday, the 22nd of May 1921. His father, Matthew, was now the only one left in the family, having buried his wife and now his only child. During the night previously, prior to the Crown Forces arriving, the church was left open and people filed past for most of the night, paying tribute to their friend. A glass panel was on the coffin so Pat could be seen, and I suppose it was something of a wake in the church, which was the best they could do in the circumstances. Floral tributes on his coffin included wreaths from the Sinn Féin and Cumann na Mban branches in Fermoy, where he had passed away. The Dunamagan Hurling Club also gave floral tributes. Pat's good friend, Father Tom Hennebury, said his funeral mass, aided by Father Purcell from Kilmaganny. The tricolour flag placed on his coffin was taken off it by the Crown Force officer in charge when it was leaving the church. The military officer also told Father Hennebury that no more than 40 people were allowed to follow the funeral cortege the short distance to the graveyard. But while in the graveyard, Ellie Peters, a local Cumann na Mban member, placed another flag on the coffin. The rosary was said around his grave in Pat's beloved Oshgaelge. After the funeral had finished, the lorries of Crown Forces left. They hadn't gone far when they heard the volley of shots fired over Pat's grave by his local IRA comrades. This was in tribute to his fallen soldier status. Of course, this infuriated the military, as they had purposely stopped the crowd scattering to prevent that happening. They returned to the graveyard, but the IRA men had already gone by then. The auxiliaries from Inistigue had roadblocks and checkpoints at a number of locations in the vicinity of the Namagan village later that day. They stopped and searched a number of people as they travelled from the funeral. The day after Pat's burial, on Monday 23rd of May, a solemn high mass was held at 10:30 a.m. in the Namagan church, again led by Father Hennebury. This allowed the locals and Pat's father to pray in peace without the military outside the door. It also allowed the clergy to travel to take part in this special mass. There was 18 priests from all the surrounding parishes and districts in attendance at the mass that day. The fatalities of the two men were widely reported nationally. The fact that the injured men were left most of the day without medical intervention made it controversial. It was considered at the the very least, ungentlemanly, if not illegal by the rules of warfare, to not provide medical assistance to an injured prisoner. The plight of Pat and Sean was even raised on the floor of the House of Commons in London when James Kiely, a Liberal MP for Whitechapel in London, queried the circumstances surrounding the deaths of the men, which he named in the House. The question occurred during a debate on the military campaign in Ireland, with Kiely being critical of his own party's role in the war in Ireland. In response, the Attorney General for Ireland, that's Dennis Henry MP, who was taking the questions, responded that he had not yet seen the military report into the affair. This is interesting to myself, as it's the only inquest report I have not been able to find in the British archives, although I can find reference to it that it exists. So if you have it out there, or maybe I'm just blind, please send it on to me. As a penalty for what happened in Tullerone that day, the British authorities closed Tullerone and Kilmarnock creameries for 2 weeks as a punishment to the locals who helped the columns. There was another grisly follow-up to events in Tullerone. In the aftermath of the Quinn Welsh fatal altercation, two British soldiers living in Kilmarnock were executed as informers by the IRA. These were 38-year-old Martin Darmody, who was from Kilmarnock and who had enlisted as a private in the Leinster Regiment of the British Army at the beginning of the First World War. He was captured by the Germans very early on in October 1914. After spending over 4 years as a prisoner of war, he was released after the war ended. He was then discharged from the army in July 1919, like thousands of other soldiers. The other man executed was Michael O'Keefe, who was approximately 55 years old and originally from Carrick-on-Shore. Both men had been working as farm labourers. It had been ascertained that they had offered their services to the Crown Forces in Kilmarnock after the IRA party had left the village on the evening of the 12th of May. The two men were said to have directed the Crown Forces around the byroads of Kilmarnock and Tullerone, leading to the area where the flying column was in Knocknamuck. The two men were captured 3 days after the events of Knocknagress, that's in the early hours of Tuesday the 17th of May 1921. They were brought to a nearby gravel quarry in Bala Old Town where they were executed. They were shot by a small party led by Ned Elward in retaliation for their helping the Crown Forces the days previously. Many years later, an IRA man named Michael Welsh told Ernie O'Malley the story he had heard about these executions. He said, quote, "There were two local men from Kilmarnock. They went into the military that night and they offered their services to them, for they knew where the men were billeted. These two men put on uniforms and they brought the military around and they showed them the houses. They were identified a night later. The two of them were captured. Jimmy Kelly, that's he, the 7th Battalion Flying Column, went into Kilmarnock and he went into a pub and dressed up as a black and tan. He had his wife with him and all, and he drank with them. They talked to him then, and when he had all the information, he marched them out, sent for a priest, and he shot them then and there," end quote. It was local man Thomas Todd Ronan who made the grim discovery in a sandpit at the quarry that morning. O'Keefe was still alive when he was found and was brought to the home of his employer John Hogan, but died shortly afterwards on that same afternoon. He had been shot in the abdomen. Darmody was shot through the heart and would have died instantly. Darmody's body contained a note sticking out of his left-hand pocket, which contained the words, "Convicted as a spy and traitor. All others beware of the IRA." When Ronan initially arrived at the scene, Darmody's dog was found lying across his body. The dog, according to one journalist, was very much attached to Darmody, and it was with the utmost difficulty that he could be separated from the lifeless body of his form of his master, faithful even in death. The dog was brought to Kilkenny Military Barracks by some of the soldiers who were anxious to adopt him as a mascot. These executions were, however, not sanctioned by IRA GHQ in Dublin. A stipulation had been brought in since at least the end of 1920 stating that permission must be sought from IRA GHQ for any form of executions, although this interference from Dublin into local matters was widely ignored around the country. Richard Mulcahy, IRA Chief of Staff and later leader of Fine Gael, wrote to the Kilkenny Brigade OC, that's Sergeant Dwyer, some weeks later stating that, quote, "It was a very serious matter that a junior officer, i.e. Ned Elward, should take it upon himself the responsibility for executing two alleged spies. The Brigade Commandant's authority is necessary before a spy can be executed. There must be no slacking in this regard to this order," end quote. A century on, Captain Pat Welsh of the Nemagen IRA is arguably the most revered and recognised casualty of that era in County Kilkenny. There is a statute to pass in his native Dunamagan, which also lists the men that fought under him in Dunamagan and also those of the Kilmagani IRA. The statue was erected in 1950 by his former comrades, and there has been a parade or commemoration there nearly every Easter Sunday since. In Knocknagress, Tullerone, there is a roadside cross to commemorate the fallen men and also a memorial in the field field where the men fell. Sean Quinn's name is also included in the monument to the fallen in Monaghan. As mentioned before, Ned Elward had a long and interesting life afterwards, ending up managing the Clover Meats factory near Ferrybank, passing away in 1976. Sean Hogan, the leader of the Tipperary column that day, moved to Dublin, married and had three children. He fell onto hard times and ended up living in the Dublin tenement, having separated from his wife. He died on Christmas Eve in 1968 and is buried in Tipperary town. Paddy Power, who fate conspired to keep alive that day in Knocknagress, lived a long life afterwards and became a very successful horse trainer and breeder. I suppose now, just to summarise, the consequences and repercussions of Friday the 13th of May 1921 turned out to be very unlucky across the board. It is humbling to think how a single event that can happen in minutes, if not seconds, can have repercussions for families and communities even down through the generations. And that's where we leave it today. Just to thank you all for listening once again. I hope you enjoyed today's podcast. And don't forget to join your local library to avail of all the amazing free resources. Until next time.